Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, we have so much to talk about. Courtroom Avenger, the challenges and triumphs of Robert Habish. Robert's story is written in book form by Kurt Chandler, and Kurt worked as a newspaper reporter, magazine writer, author. He's the editor of Milwaukee Magazine, has written for the New York Times and a number of other publications, and has put together a really compelling story. You couldn't have such a story without a pretty compelling person, and that person is Robert Habish. He's a trial lawyer. He's one of the most successful trial lawyers in America, has been representing the underdog for over 55 years, and has won many very important cases. He's compelled many, many industries to improve the design of products that have caused harm or fatal injuries to users. The list of changes that Kurt highlights in the book in product design as a result of Bob Habish's work goes on for pages. He was president of the American Trial Lawyers Association and the past president of American Association for Justice. An attorney in Boston says that Bob is a giant among the nation's trial lawyers. It will go through many of the cases because they are profoundly interesting and very important, and I've been looking forward to this conversation with Bob and with Kurt. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Bob Habish, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I haven't seen you. Last time I saw you, I interviewed you for a nighttime show I was doing on WTMJ, and you said to me, "You got to think about becoming a lawyer," and I never did it.
You should have.
Yeah, maybe I should have. Kurt Chandler, it's a really interesting book. It really is. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I'd like to start with early life. And in your case, Bob, the early life is pretty remarkable because the amount of anti-Semitism you had to deal with as a young child, I mean, some of it is really heartbreaking. Your best and only friend who wouldn't let you in the house, and what you had to deal with in high school, and you write about it so well and thoroughly. That would put a fire in your belly that maybe could carry you through a good portion of your life.
Well, of course, you know, when you're 5 years old or that age and that stuff happens to you, you can't get your head around that.
Yeah.
Like when Norman, my best friend, told me I couldn't come into his house because his brother said I killed Jesus. Mm. I mean, I didn't know what that meant, and I, as the book says, I ran home and asked my mom what, you know, Norman told me I killed Jesus. Who's he? And then it continued because I was in a public school that had, I was the only Jewish boy. And so the other boys thought they'd make a target out of me, which lasted not too long, because I then decided that instead of having four against one, I would take one on one, and that ended. But it continued, you know, and what it did, Kathleen, it made me feel different, mm-hmm. you know, that I was different, and it started building that chip on my shoulder, which grew to an enormous size as time went on. And I never thought for once that I would pretend I wasn't Jewish, you know, to escape this. To me, it just made me more determined to defend it. And I'm sure that was the start of a personality of feeling like an underdog. And wanting to fight back, not run away. Mm-hmm. As it evolved, it continued through that time until I went to high school. And then even in high school, I experienced it with that football coach, you know, who...
You couldn't play on Friday night.
I couldn't play on a high holiday. I wanted to. My father insisted that if I wanted to live in the house, I had nowhere to go. I couldn't go anywhere else, that I had to go observe that holiday and missed the first game of the season, and that ended my short-lived football career because at that point I was a bench sitter. So it didn't end, mm-hmm. you know, and it just continued to make an impression upon me. But what never left me was this feeling of being an outsider looking in, mm-hmm. you know, like I had my nose to the window looking in and what everyone else, I just wasn't the same as everyone else, and I'm sure it had a part in my later attitude about what I was going to do for in my life professionally.
And taking an alliance with the underdog, taking care of the underdogs.
Right. I didn't have any trouble empathizing with the people who were up against powerful interests and whose life had been set asunder by terrible accidents and events. It was easy for me to empathize, and I think that that empathy transmitted to a jury where they knew I was sincere. Mm-hmm. This wasn't just a lawyer talking, but a lawyer who felt what was going on in their lives, and I think that was an important part of the success that I was able to have with juries.
And the success, Kurt, is amazing. I've lived here for years and years, and I'm familiar with many of Mr. Habish's cases, but I wasn't familiar with probably, you know, two-thirds of them. The list of successes is incredible. I mean, page after page of extraordinary changes in high chairs and in cars and all kinds of things as a result of his efforts.
Well, not only did he push the envelope on really protecting consumers, but he took on enormous industries mm-hmm. and corporations. You know, he took on Big Pharma. He worked on the tobacco settlement for the state of Wisconsin. He took on the automotive industry. Back in the day, you know, the automotive industry, as Bob will tell you, was very reluctant to even install seatbelts in cars. And they, you know, they were finally coerced, you know, kicking and dragging their feet into including seatbelts in the front of the car, but they still resisted seatbelts in the back. And Bob played a role through the cases that he tried in reforming the design of automobiles. Mm-hmm. That's just one example. But, you know, he would take on forces, especially in his the early part of his career, that were outspending Bob and his firm by what? By 10, by 100.
Well, they had unlimited checkbooks, you know.
Right.
And but when they learned that we were willing to expend dollar for dollar against them, they got the message after a while. But it took several times to smack them on the side of the head, so to speak, with a 2x4, for them to get their attention. And there were other lawyers around the country who did the same thing. I'm not the only one who took on these giants who just thought safety wouldn't sell. Mm-hmm. Now you see safety does sell. When mm-hmm. you watch the ads on TV, like Subaru and other companies, safety sells. But you couldn't convince marketing in those days that safety sells.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend some time, because it's a very moving part of the story. And when we talk about the anti-Semitism you faced, you also had a daughter who was very badly harmed by a drug that was given to her, and knowing that there were bad side effects to this, the doctors knew, and she was given this anyhow because of the contributions that were given to the Mayo Clinic, I believe. It plays a prominent role in several parts of the book. Talk about your daughter, because, again, it's the fire in the belly and how she was wronged and what you did about it, in many ways what you did about it.
Well, Sherry was born in 1960. She was born as a normal baby. She then was given the usual vaccinations, but instead of just the diphtheria, tetanus, and whooping cough, Park Davis had included a polio shot. It was called Quadrigine, 4-in-1, and basically they hadn't tested it, or if they did, they didn't advise FDA or anyone else of the consequences that they found in testing. The addition of the polio element made the pertussis unstable, which is unstable anyways, and she got brain damaged. Mm. Now, she started having seizures, and we took her to doctors and ended up at the Mayo Clinic, and they all said, you know, this happens, you know, you're just bad luck. Never intimated that it might have been the vaccination. And so for several years, we believed we caused it. which gives you a lot of guilt.
I'm sure.
We were afraid to have other children because of that. And about 5 years after that, we got a call from a woman whose son had experienced the same event, and she had found out that there were a couple cases around the country that held Park Davis accountable for this Quadrigen, which we found out later had been recalled off the market after they damaged God knows how many kids. So when I found out, I researched it. I pulled in all the files from these other two states. One was New York, one was North Dakota, and studied the cases and the science. I then set up a meeting with the pediatric neurologist at Mayo who had lied to us. I confronted him. I said, "You owe us. You caused a great deal of pain to us. Now I want you to be an expert for me, and we're going to sue Park Davis." And we did. I hired a couple lawyers, and because I was the client, I couldn't do it myself. And we demonstrated to Park Davis how wrong they were. And they set up a trust fund for Sherry, which still exists today, to be able to take care of her in the event anything happens to us. So that's story. And then an outgrowth of that is Sherry became a very terrific swimmer in Special Olympics, swam like a fish. And we were in Madison at the state finals because she was at the finals. And I saw the pediatrician who had given her the shot, who I never sued, by the way. I thought Park Davis was quite enough. But he knew what happened, and he knew what was wrong. I went over to him, and I said, "You see Sherry there?" "Yes, Mr. Habish, I saw her there. She's doing quite well." I said, "Yes, she is." And I said, "I see you are now an advisor to the Special Olympics." I said, "I find that kind of interesting what under the scary circumstances." He said, "Well, Mr. Habish," he says, "I've felt guilty ever since what happened to Sherry, and I thought I had to do something to redeem myself, and so I've been helping the Special Olympics ever since." I said, "Well, doctor, I guess you're a better doctor today." And so that was, I guess, chapter two of the Sherry story.
Yeah.
And finally, Sherry, they had no school for her. So all these kids would be at home watching TV, and there was no public education. You know, you went to curative workshop, and you did the best you could with therapy. And one of my good friends, Bronson LaFollette, and I graduated law school together. He was the attorney general. Went to him, and I said, "I read the Wisconsin Constitution, and it shows there should be free public education for all children. And I didn't see any asterisks that it excluded blind or deaf or brain-damaged children." He did a attorney general opinion, and he said, "You're right. It's unconstitutional for the public school system not to take care of your daughter and all these other handicapped children." I said, "Okay." So I wrote a letter to the school board, school district. We were living in the Glendale district at that time. And I said, "Here's the deal. I send here's the opinion. I'd like to meet with you." So they met with me, and I said, "Folks," I said, "you got two plans here. Plan A is you hire a special ed teacher for my daughter. Plan B is I take you to court for a few years." Which you would choose? "We can't hire a special ed for one person." I said, "Trust me. You hire the special ed, you announce a special ed, and you will see 50 kids come out of the woodwork."
Right.
Well, they did. They chose non-litigation. They hired a special ed teacher, and my prediction was right. 50 children came out to that class, and that was the start of special ed in the North Shore District, which then was extended into Nicolet High School. I visited them again when she was about to go to high school, and they said, "Oh, not you again." I said, "Yep." I said, "Now we go to high school," and they did. And Nicolet had the finest special ed system probably in Wisconsin. So that's the Sherry. That's the whole Sherry story.
Yeah, isn't that a story? I mean, I had no idea. It's something I never thought of. When did special ed classes start in many schools? It's amazing. There weren't any then, isn't it, Kurt?
It is. The Sherry story and stories really follow a theme in Bob's professional life. Certainly not his personal life, but going even farther back to, you know, when he finally took on the bullies that confronted him in high school, in middle school. He learned that he had to fight back, and it was important for him to get even, and even the score with people who wronged him or people that he loved, including his daughter, or people who hired him as clients. In fact, the working title of the book was at one time called Getting Even, because that was really the spirit and the goal that Bob had, and not in a vindictive way, but just, as I said before, to settle the score, whether it was through a settlement or a trial, you know, making people essentially pay for the wrongs that they did. And I think that's a very admirable trait, because he became a protector in some ways, and even a crusader, you know, when he was trying to make changes in law, you know, that protect the consumers, you know, whether they're using pharmaceuticals or passengers in cars. So it's really been something that has carried on throughout Bob's professional life.
Well, you've seen some really terrible things in your life too, Bob. So many of these cases are people who are severely disfigured or burned, or they died, or they were widows of the crane operator at Miller Park, or little girls who were burned because flame retardant wasn't used to make a quick buck from some clothing place, people, cars that weren't good. I mean, that's hard to witness all of that and how people have been damaged in so many significant ways.
You know, Kathleen, what happened to Sherry pissed me off, and I just never got over. I never stopped being pissed off. Even till today, I can't get rid of that. And so when you see stuff like that, I remember one of the most heartbreaking stories that in the book is the John Carroll story, the insurance salesman who went in for open-heart surgery and got a blood transfusion that contained AIDS, virus. And it was unnecessary because the blood center had left the bad stuff on the shelf, and they had tested good stuff that they just wanted to work out the inventory. I mean, come on. So I had to take on all the blood centers in the country because they all came into Milwaukee during the trial to defend the Wisconsin blood center, Southeastern Wisconsin Blood Center. But it was a righteous cause, and John Carroll, who was alive at the time during the trial and gave the most eloquent explanation of how he's suffering, and he died shortly after the trial. That was the kind of cases that really make you feel you're doing something really important. And that's still one of my favorite cases.
Really?
The John Carroll case against the blood centers.
And tell me this story, because it must have taken a lot of detective work to find out where, and it did take a lot of detective work, the pajamas that were sold at Kmart, the little girl was playing with a cigarette lighter or something, it caught on fire, she was very badly burned, and you had to track down where this came from, and it's really an interesting story, but it's almost like you needed private eyes to find out the answer, right?
Well, one of the people that I give a lot of credit to the success that I've had was my investigator, Terry Tadasak. He was a sheriff at Cuba City, Wisconsin, and the reason he lost his job is because he indicted the mayor, which didn't go over well.
I imagine.
And so I hired him, and he started with me right at the beginning, the early cases in the book. Terry was there, so he got on-the-job training from me and saw what was necessary to properly prepare for trial and investigate. And he has amazing tenacity and smart as hell. And so he found a lot of these hidden secrets and witnesses for me during the years, including that case in which they were doing this renegade plant in Tennessee that was making children's sleepwear without the flame retardant, and they were hidden, you know. And I sent him out there. I said, Terry, go out there, find this company, don't come back until you do. And he'd found it in the mountains. So a lot of A lot of credit goes to the people who work on those cases with me, and especially a guy like Terry.
Yeah. And when you, all the cases that you and Bob had, can remember all of these too, which is amazing. Yeah. You know, I can't remember half of my life at this point, but he's always case after case.
Exactly.
When you look at, when he answered the case that was most meaningful to him, the Blood Center case, as you heard all of them, which one was most meaningful to you? Because they all are meaningful stories.
Well, they're meaningful and interesting in different ways. I mean, he represented a young man with a young wife and a family who worked in a sawmill. And this was one of his early cases. And there was not a protective device on the sawmill that he operated. And he really was never told how to operate essentially the on-off switch or the pause switch for the saw. And one day he was literally pulled into the saw and both of his legs were amputated. And Bob represented him pretty much doing all the work himself, you know, all the investigation early on in his career. And he won an award for this young man, who went on then to become mayor of Prairie du Chien,
right,
and lived, you know, a very fulfilling life.
And Kurt had a chance to interview him. He unfortunately passed away from cancer, but Kurt had a chance to interview him, and he quoted him in the book. Jack McPhee was his name. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was another case. You know, I have to think of these cases because they're all different, but they resonate in a different way. There was a case, fascinating, a young man named Larry Totsky was driving his Volkswagen Beetle one day, and suddenly he lost control of it. It rolled over one of the freeway interchanges, and he was paralyzed. Well, how did this happen? People thought, well, it was operator failure. But Bob and his investigators tracked down the very place where this Volkswagen was manufactured in Germany, did some sleuthing, really, and found remarkably that cement chips on the ceiling of this factory had broken free, fallen down into the assembly line and into the gearbox of this one particular car, causing it later, in later years, to jam the gearbox and disabled the car when Larry Totsky was driving it. So remarkable.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I mean, who even thought of that? Who thought that that could be a possibility? That was a one in a million
well,
discovery,
right,
wasn't it?
When we examined the gearbox, we found this lump, you know, and then I turned it over to a metallurgist who put it under electron microscope and found out it had all the elements of concrete. So how in the hell did concrete get into a steering gearbox?
Right.
So I had them produce the plant manager, and I had one question to either win the case or lose the case. I asked him, what is the ceiling made of? If he had said wood, I'd been out the door. but when he said concrete, touchdown.
Right.
You know.
Right.
That was one of those cases where you violate the rule, don't ask a question when you don't know the answer. I just had to ask the question to hold my breath. You know, and that was it. And of course, we had to try the case; it never settled. Volkswagen wouldn't admit fault for anything. That lasted 6 weeks. That trial. That was probably the largest verdict in Wisconsin at that time. It was in the '70s, late '70s, as I recall.
Mm. We welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd like to hear from you. We're talking about the incredible work of Robert Habish, trial lawyer for over 55 years. And has done such important work that has changed the safety of so many products and righted the wrongs of many who have been severely injured. He's the subject of a new book, and the author of the book is with us as well. The book is Courtroom Avenger, The Challenges and Triumphs of Robert Habish. And Kurt Chandler is the writer. Kurt is the editor of Milwaukee Magazine. He's also author of several other books, Shaving Lessons, A Memoir of Father and Son, and Passage of Pride, Lesbian and Gay Youth Come of Age. He's written for a number of publications, and we welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We want to talk a bit about big tobacco as well, and the suit against Mitsubishi. Many of you will remember that case here in Milwaukee. Former Governor Jim Doyle says in a blurb on the back of the book, "When I wanted the very best lawyer to represent the people of Wisconsin in the largest piece of litigation in state history against the massive force of big tobacco, I chose Bob, and he came through, and the settlement was huge." We will talk about that case and many others. Here's how you reach us. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Robert Habish and Kurt Chandler are with us in our Milwaukee studios, and our phone number, if you'd like to talk about any of these cases, talk about personal injury law, tort reform, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Let's remember the big tobacco settlement, because it was huge in this state, and taking on big tobacco was also a very significant thing that you have done in your lifetime, and it's amazing how that people don't smoke as much anymore, and it's a big change. How did you become involved in that case?
Well, Jim Doyle called me one day, and he said there's a bunch of attorney generals around the country that are thinking of suing big tobacco, and it's not for an individual. It's to recover the expenses, medical expenses that the states have had to incur from diseases caused by smoking, such as heart disease and cancer. So it'll be about those expenses, not an individual case. And I'd like to have Wisconsin join, and I'd like you to lead the group, and of course with your law firm. And I'm going to ask a couple other law firms to join as well, but you're going to be the lead lawyer. And so he asked another Milwaukee law firm, and then a law firm from Janesville, a very, very prominent litigation firm. And we just formed a team, and one of the Milwaukee firms got replaced by another firm because Tommy Thompson, who was the governor at that time, was not thrilled about suing Big Tobacco because Miller Brewing Company, you know, was part of that umbrella industry, and they were obviously a big employer here in Wisconsin. But Doyle kept pushing and pushing on it, and finally the governor approved it, but he wanted to have his law firm as part of the team, you know, and I think it'd be fair to describe them as Republican law firm. And I said, fine, I don't care, you know. So anyways, we embarked upon over a year of research and hiring experts around the country. We were aided by a Minnesota group that had successfully sued tobacco and were actually in trial when we got hired. So we had a lot of their work product and used a lot of their experts. We expended over $1 million out of our pockets in expenses. And we put together one hell of a case. I mean, we really had a good case. We were in front of a Madison judge, Judge Moser, and we had a trial date. We were a month away from trial, and we were ready. In fact, we were the only state that sued the American Tobacco that made the tobacco, chewing tobacco, mm-hmm. which, you know, all the athletes had the chewing
sure.
tobacco, and kids,
yeah.
kids were following their lead and getting cancer of the tongue and the mouth. So we sued them, too. I said, why not? You know, they cause cancer, too. So anyways, the settlement, they then settled the case right out from under us, they being the attorney generals. Wisconsin recovered $6 billion, which was, much of it was supposed to be for tobacco education, anti-smoking education, and repay the state for all the money they laid out for these diseases for a period of time, 5 years. Of course, that money went south when a legislature subsequently balanced the budget with the tobacco money. Not much, you know, I or anyone else could have done about that. But it was a sensational victory. There still is anti-tobacco publicity and programs in place from that settlement.
It also prevented some advertising by big tobacco. The Joe Camel advertisements, for example. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, we found documents that would make your hair stand up straight.
Really?
Where they actually knew that nicotine was addictive, that they sent all the free cigarettes to the soldiers and sailors in World War II because they knew they would get hooked, and I'd have generations then hooked on cigarettes. This is in documents. They didn't know about shredding then, you know. I mean, it was just unbelievable admissions, and that's, of course, why they settled, and many of the cases that have gone to trial have been successful for individual people.
Hmm. How do you keep, some of what you've seen must just fill you with this great anger, you know, righteous anger that would make me, you know, the Irish in me just go, yeah, get furious and sort of lose the ability to be calm, which you need to be in a courtroom. How do you contain that kind of anger?
You channel it.
Really?
You channel it, just like I channeled Sherry's illness and, you know, and my personal experiences. You focus it and put it in a little tube, and you laser-like attack the perpetrators with a sense of righteousness and vengeance, if you will. And there's nothing that is more exciting and pleasurable when you've got someone on the witness stand who's an expert for the people you're suing, and they realize that you know as much as they do, and you can see the fear in their eyes. I mean, that's a big thrill.
Yeah.
So that's what it is. It you know, when you represent the right and you represent people who are injured and you represent people like the state of Wisconsin and the taxpayers, you're on the side of the angels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're against the bad guys. What could be a more pleasurable occupation than that?
Well, there, as you well know, because you have led the effort nationally on tort reform, there's been this huge movement while you've been a lawyer, too, to limit many of these damages. Can you talk a little bit, Kurt, you want to start about Bob's efforts to keep places from putting a cap on damages?
Sure. He was a member, an officer, and eventually the president of a group named ATLA, the American Trial Lawyers Association, mm-hmm. which now is the American Association of Justice. And in that role, he was very instrumental in holding back tort reform legislation in the states around the country. And he did it by good, heavy-handed lobbying. I mean, you were based in Washington much of the time. You were president, of course, and well, you can speak to some of your efforts at that juncture in your life. But that was one of his, you know, roles as an activist. Mm-hmm.
I would have taken that job for life. I loved that job. What I did is I just organized. I brought in all the best trial lawyers from every state, and I said, "You folks, you are now a war council." Okay. And you're going to go around and you're going to talk to your senators and your representatives one-on-one, and you're going to sit in their office and you're going to remind them that trial lawyers have always been friends, you know, of yours, and you expect to protect the rights of the consumers. And it was just direct, hardball lobbying. We hired the best lobbying firm in D.C., Tommy Boggs' firm, who has since passed away. But it was war, and I love war. I mean, it was.
You liked ROTC, too, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a part of a pattern. Let's go to some phone calls. Robert Habish is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. Kenneth in Janesville. Hi.
Hi. There's a rating system for doctors, basically a report card on everything they do. Is there a same website for lawyers? And I haven't heard the word justice mentioned. How do you feel about justice?
Well, justice defines a righteous solution to both people who are wronged in a criminal justice system and people who are wronged in the civil justice system. And that's why they call it justice. That's why they call the Supreme Court justices. And so my definition of justice is even the playing field for people who don't have the power against the people who do. And that's my definition of justice. And there are rating systems for lawyers. The American Bar Association has a rating system. An AV rating is for the best of rating you can get as a lawyer. And there's sites now on the internet where lawyers are rated by their clients. And also various organizations, if you're invited into various prestigious organizations, it shows that you're in the top 1%, 2% of the trial bar. So if you belong, for instance, to the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, it's only 500 lawyers in the world. And so if you're invited into that, as I was, and others as well, that tells people that you have something a little more, a little something special that you've accomplished in your career.
Thank you very much for your call. Let's go next to Lauren in Burlington. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Kathleen. I just wanted to comment to Mr. Habish. I used to be an insurance claims rep, and I dealt extensively with a lot of litigation, and I've done litigation in all 50 states. And I just wanted to let him know that his firm, at least in my eyes, was the easiest, the most professional, and the most reasonable to work with. And it sounds from what I'm listening to Mr. Habish speak that it came directly from him. That he taught people that worked for him under his name, his ethics and his style of working. I just wanted to let him know that I appreciated it because my job was not easy.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Cindy in Fox Cities. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Cindy. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, the Republicans here in Wisconsin have passed the legislation to reduce awards for, companies that do harm. I'm just wondering, is that, something that's going to affect us greatly? Are there ways to get around that?
Well, the irony of caps on recovery is that the most seriously injured are the ones who are most adversely affected. And so someone who's a quadriplegic who can't recover full damages and full costs of care for the rest of his or her life is hurt by this cap, whereas someone who's less seriously injured can get 100% recovery. There's been many challenges of the unconstitutionality of the caps. Many states' Supreme Courts have held it unconstitutional. Our Supreme Court, up to this point in time, has allowed a cap of $750,000 in some instances, and for pain and suffering. And what it does, it penalizes children who don't have lost income and the elderly who may not have lost income as well. There's a financial disincentive to lawyers that can't take on expensive cases because the recovery won't even cover your expenses because of the caps. It's a cynical way to protect wrongdoers, and so therefore they don't have to buy as much insurance or not. It's an evil system, and the word tort reform is about the most mislabeled term I can imagine, because tort reform is not tort reform, it's tort deform.
Thanks very much for the call. You even took on, I found this interesting, maybe because I used to work at WTMJ, and for a long, long time, and the station really switched its format after I left. You took on a conservative talk show host in this town, too, which finds its way in the book, and I just thought that was, because I'm a talk show host, found that to be rather interesting. Would you like to talk about that?
Well,
it's in the book, so I figured
it's fair game. It's in the book. There is a certain talk show host in Milwaukee who I think has from time to time gone over the line, legally speaking, and defamed the integrity of certain public officials and others. And he always used me as the poster child. Every time he was mad at lawyers, he would bring up my name. I wasn't involved with any of the stuff that he was angry about, but, It was easy to say, well, Bob Habish is one of those lawyers. Well, talking about the tobacco settlement, he thought that our request was excessive and talked about that a great deal for a fee. We eventually discarded our contract with the state and took much less than we were contractually entitled to. So he was very energetic in criticizing me.
By name.
By name. And at one time, he then said that I was dishonest as compared to another law firm that he mentioned. Well, I sent that out to Ohio State professor who wrote a book on defamation, and I said, tell me something. I said, is this legitimate defamation? He said, yes, it is. You got a case. I said, okay. So I then wrote WTMJ that I intended to sue them and the talk show host, and they were in my office the next day. And Bob, you know, don't do this. You know, can't we do anything? I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I don't need the money, but I'd like to meet with this gentleman face-to-face, and I'd like you to be there as a witness, and I'll see what happens. And I met with him, and I shook his hand, which I thought was interesting. And I said, do you know me? He says, of course I know you. No, I said, no, do you know me? Well, I just know you. Reputation. I said, do you know that I've never been charged with a grievance? I've never been accused of any unethical conduct, that I'm a philanthropist, that I teach at the law school, that I've written books, that I have the one of the finest reputations of a personal injury lawyer in the state of Wisconsin, maybe in the country. Did you know that? No, I didn't know that. I said, then why did you defame me? He says, I defamed you? I played him the tape because we had taped the show. What can I do? He said. I said, here's what you can do. Tomorrow, you get on the show and tell people you just met me, what a fine gentleman I am, and if anyone thought that you said that I was dishonest, he didn't mean that I'm not dishonest, and that people should absolutely not think that I'm just a fine gentleman and lawyer. Okay. So the next day, I had to listen to that show, which was torture. Until the second hour, he got on, and he says, you know, guess who I met today? I met Bob Habish. And I want to tell you something. He's a terrific guy, honest guy, and if anyone thought that didn't think that he was honest and wonderful, put that aside. And by the way, if I ever got hit by a bus, I would hire him.
Now this is...
That was the settlement.
That's a story.
That was the settlement.
Yeah.
You know, this really goes to Bob's style as a warrior. He likes to call himself a warrior, and the title of the book is Courtroom Avenger. But as I said earlier, it's not in a vindictive way. Curiously, a lot of defense attorneys have tried to trip him up in the courtroom during trials. I mean, literally have tried to knock him off balance, just to knock him off of his game. But he has a demeanor in the courtroom where he outfoxes people, such as this WTMJ talk show host, and is able to, again, get even, settle the score, level the playing field, with whichever cliche you want to use, just simply by his legal acumen. And his astounding memory and ability to make people eat their words. This was a classic example.
More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking this hour with Robert Habish and Kurt Chandler. Kurt has written a very moving and really interesting biography of Robert Habish, who's done so much. I wasn't even familiar with a good two-thirds of it. He's been impressive list of achievements, safety for many more Americans as a result of his work. The book is Courtroom Avenger, The Challenges and Triumphs of Robert Habish. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to more phone calls for Robert Habish. Chris in Burlington. Hi, Chris.
Hi. My question is, my husband was hurt on the job. He fell down some stairs. And he had talked to several lawyers And they all said, well, for workman's comp issues, really there's just a standard procedure. It's not even worth hiring a lawyer. You know, you just get paid this standard payment. And I kept talking about it, well, that's weird, because he had just had a baby, and I couldn't work because he could not care for our baby. So I, in turn, lost my income as well. But I just thought that was weird. And then not only that, but the settlement that they gave him, they didn't even give him, like, a lump sum. They only paid him $303 a week for 1 year.
Do you handle a lot of workman's comp? Is it unusual to not get a lawyer?
I did early in my career, but we now refer those cases out to workers' comp specialists.
Uh-huh.
And they do pay a lump. They don't pay lump sums. Usually it's payable monthly based upon a chart of the injury.
Uh-huh. So it would behoove somebody to get legal help for a situation like what she described?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Corey is next in Watertown. Hi, Corey.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, Corey, how are you?
I wanted to thank Bob personally. Back in, I think it was like 83, his firm represented me with when Davis was part of it. And talk about integrity and being a warrior. All the insurance company has to do is see the Habish letterhead, and they start to cower. As soon as he was brought onto my case, they settled almost immediately for the full amount. And Habish and his partners, instead of taking the full 33%, they only took 25%, and I thought that was awful super of them.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your call. All right, Deborah in Madison. Hi, Deborah. Running short on time, everybody.
I found your story very inspiring, and I just wanted to say this. I have a saying: it's bad things are good things in disguise. And what I wrote down here is: bad things are good things in disguise. Robert Habish, you are the good thing. No disguise needed.
Thank you. Very nice.
Thank you, Deborah, very much for your call. One more phone call. Mary Jane in Platteville. Hi.
Hi, Mr. Habish. I am very proud to speak with you for just a moment, and I'd like to ask you, do you have future contentions of throwing your hat into the ring for a Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin?
I should run for Supreme Court justice?
I think that that's the advice you're being given.
Are you going to announce today?
No. Well, thank you for that compliment. I don't think I have the temperament to be a judge or a justice. I'm kind of a perfectionist, and if I saw an attorney who wasn't performing up to the standard that I think attorneys should perform, I would tend to be rather critical. So I've backed away from the opportunities to be a judge or a justice, but I thank you for the compliment.
And you really do still enjoy being in the courtroom. I mean, you could be on a beach somewhere pretty much whenever you want to be. And
right.
You like
right.
to work still.
Oh, yeah. I still have the fire in my belly. I don't know when it's going to go away. Most people think it won't, who know me.
Mm-hmm.
Others keep asking, when are you going to retire? And I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I'm going
to have to.
I think I've redefined retirement. I'm told my firm recently I'm just going to hang around, and they don't have to buy me a watch, you know, if they have a retirement party. Just hang around, and, you know.
Let him buy you a watch.
He's invented a whole new theory of retirements, the hang-around retirement plan.
Thank you both so much for being with us. It's quite a life. I'm glad you wrote the book, Kurt. It's good.
Thank
you, Kathleen.
Thank you both. Robert Habish, the book is Courtroom Avenger, The Challenges and Triumphs of Robert Habish. Kurt Chandler is the author of the book, and Kurt is familiar to you as well. He's editor of Milwaukee Magazine. He's the author of several other books and has written for some top-notch publications in this country. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. They were appreciated. Great conversations ahead. We're with you tomorrow. We'll talk about long-term care and proposed changes in the Wisconsin budget, the first hour of our program. Thanks for listening.